Few Takes on Terror. We speak with IMA program director Marty Lucas about his new documentary, Hiroshima Bound, Growing Up in the Atomic Age, and we'll play an experimental audio piece from Kate Kunith. This is Cassie, one of your IMA radio hosts. It's 11 o'clock, Wednesday morning, March 3rd, 2010, and today is our inaugural show. We're broadcasting live from WHCS, the Hunter College radio station, located on the first floor of the Thomas Hunter Building. So before we get to Vandana, we have some announcements about upcoming events around Hunter and screenings of IMA work around the city. First, tomorrow on March 4th is a National Day of Action to fight budget cuts to higher education. There's a walkout planned at Hunter College for tomorrow on Thursday, organized by the Hunter Student Union. Student, faculty, and staff can meet outside the Hunter main campus at 2 p.m. and march to the Borough of Manhattan Community College for a 3 p.m. rally, followed by a 4 p.m. rally outside Governor Patterson's office. If you want more information, they do have a blog, march4ny.wordpress.com. Also on Monday is the first night of a Department of Film and Media lecture series featuring young New York City artists. And this week is Amber Hawk Swanson. She's a multimedia artist who works in video, performance, and other mediums. And one of her projects was the creation of an Amber doll, a life-size sex doll created in her exact likeness. She took the Amber doll to disrupt wedding receptions, roller skating rinks, football, tailgating parties, theme parks, and adult industry conventions, documenting the process in video and photography. Amber Hawk Swanson will be in room 502 in Hunter North from 8 to 9 on Monday, March 8th. Also coming up in the next few weeks is the second annual CUNY Film Festival on Saturday, March 20th at the McCully Honors College on West 67th Street. And we'll be speaking with the organizer of the festival on our March 17th show. Also coming up in April is the Subversive event, which is a week-long exploration of gender politics, sexuality, and performance organized by artist, photographer, and IMA student Ryan Joseph. And the series kicks off with a live burlesque performance on April 9th. And we'll be speaking with Ryan more about Subversive on April 7th on our show. IMA alum Sarah Nelson Wright has an installation currently as a part of the Gentrification of Brooklyn exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary African Diaspora Arts. Her piece is Locations and Dislocation, and it will be there until May 16th. Also, save the date, March 31st, is Threat Level Queer Shorts presenting Channeling, an invocation of spectral bodies and queer shorts. Also, just so you know, we are accepting events and submissions. If you have an upcoming screening anywhere in the city, or if you'd like to come to on the show and talk about your work, give us an email, imaradioshow@gmail.com. That's imaradioshow@gmail.com. Next up is Vandana, but first, here's Shilpa Ray and our Happy Hookers with Filthy and Free.
Thank you. media loves terror, and terrorism has been the hot topic since Kami went out of fashion in the early 90s. IMA alum Vandana Sood has her own take on terror with her thesis project, The Taxi Takes on Terror. We all saw Vandana's work at her thesis exhibition in December, and we are so excited to have her here as one of our first guests on IMA Radio. Welcome, Vandana.
Thank you.
Your project takes place online at thetaxitakes.com. There are videos, polls to vote on, photos, news, blogs. It's awesome. For our listeners, can you explain exactly what is The Taxi Takes on Terror?
Sure. Firstly, you know, I'm so excited to be here, and congratulations to all of you for getting this going. The Taxi Takes on Terror is basically a video project based on conversations between taxi drivers and passengers in Mumbai taxis. The conversations are based around the terrorist attack, which took place in November 2008. And the aim of the project is to have a dialogue amongst ordinary people of various backgrounds. And hence, the documentary exists online so as to introduce more and more people to the conversations which took place in the taxis and allow them to participate in that conversation.
Awesome. It's such a great project. Thank you so much. We're actually going to start off listening to a clip from the project. You can see the videos and the blogs on www.thetaxitakes.com. And here is a clip to give you an idea.
Over short distances, taxis are the only form of public transportation in South Mumbai. Three-wheelers or auto rickshaws are banned. Local trains only go to main junctions. So most people have to take a taxi. In India, the caste system has prevailed for centuries. Caste, class, education, and religion divide people on a daily basis. The taxi is a public space where people of various socio-economic backgrounds and religions meet. To overcome the divide, it's important to have an open and candid conversation, especially when the dialogue is about terrorism, since terrorism does not discriminate and universally impacts humanity.
Again, the website for this project is www.thetaxitakes.com. Vandana, I was looking over the website a lot, and I was reading some of the blogs. There are some really provocative conversations happening, which I'm sure you're really excited about, because that's kind of probably what you were going for. I read one conversation addressing the problem with calling the bombing in Mumbai India's 9/11. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, right after the attack took place, I, of course, was sitting in New York when it took place, but a lot of the news and the broadcasters were terming the attack India's 9/11, which brought up several issues, and I was trying to address that. So, of course, there's, you know, the issue of if and how this attack in India was related to circumstances post 9/11, if any. There was the sort of repercussions of using that language and that terminology, because as we know, the world as it exists right now is completely different post 9/11, you know. So there was a lot of discussion about that. And then, of course, in the last piece that I worked on, which is as of now not online, I've brought up this perspective of how India did not go to war after the terrorist attack. And hence, you know, that is a really interesting way of saying, is it really India's 9/11? Because the policies post 9/11 were, of course, far more aggressive.
Very good point. What is the name of the last piece that you said is not online?
India's 9/11? Question mark.
Okay. When will it be online?
I'm having some issues with uploading, but
okay.
Hopefully, actually, right after the show, I'm going to try and see what's happening with Blip TV.
Great. So our viewers can actually get online after the show and see your new piece.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay, so let's just back up a bit. Give us an overview of how you made this project happen. When did it all start?
Well, the attack took place in November 2008. January, I left for India. I reached Mumbai probably in February, and that's when I decided to see if this concept that I had come up with was even possible. You know, it's one thing to go on the streets of New York and interview taxi drivers, which I had done, but it's another thing to actually enter that taxi while the driver is, you know, doing what he does and driving passengers all around the city. And then, of course, getting the, you know, getting a camera in that space and trying to actually record and document a conversation is a totally different thing. So I did all sorts of experiments on my first trip, meeting with actual taxi drivers, speaking to them, trying to understand the city itself because I'm new to Mumbai, or Bombay as I prefer to call it. I'm from New Delhi. And then I took a second trip and really started filming.
So why did you choose taxi drivers and taxis as your vehicle, both metaphorically and not, and literally? Why did you choose that, and how did you get access to the taxi drivers?
Okay, good question. The reason why I chose a taxi was because I wanted to find a space where I could find, you know, common people from various backgrounds. I could have also found, you know, I could have also gone to a bus stop or a marketplace, but the possibility of trying to get a few people on, in that bus stop to have a conversation for a period of time would have probably been really hard. There would have been external conditions which would have not allowed a really nice, intimate conversation to take place. While a taxi provides, one, a public place in a sense, but also, two, an intimate setting. And the third thing is you've got this really nice journey taking place, and hence the people, as happens all around the world, just sort of spontaneously start talking, you know, to the other person without really feeling like, you know, they might necessarily meet the person again or have any qualms or worries about what they're saying. So I thought that a taxi had all that potential. And of course, you know, given being a documentary filmmaker, I realized that, you know, that's the one place in Mumbai where I could actually have a mic and capture just those conversations as opposed to all the other noise which is happening in that city.
Why did you decide to have the taxi drivers conduct the interview rather than yourself?
Well, I tried to choose taxi drivers who were, first of all, who had a personal relationship to the attack. So I tried to find drivers who were, you know, at the locations of Taj, Leopold, Victoria Terminus, and hence had, you know, a very personal experience and a particular viewpoint about terrorism. So I knew that then when they spoke, their questions or their conversation with their passengers would be even more heightened, as opposed to someone who is, you know, not affected, sitting at home, didn't have a point of view. And as opposed to me really being the questionnaire, or sorry, not the questionnaire, but the questioning person, the interviewer, sorry. I decided the taxi driver was really a person who had, well, each taxi driver has their own unique story. They're very much, you know, close to what happens in that city. They have a really great relationship to the people and the, you know, the environment. And I think that that perspective, when gelled with whoever comes into that taxi, whatever passenger it might be, is far more dynamic as opposed to me just asking the same questions, you know, having sat in New York, not really been on the ground, so to speak, when the attack took place.
Yeah, and I also love the class situation that you're setting up, which I think is a really powerful part of your project in total, and I think people get a lot by watching it on your website at www.thetaxitakes.com. There's so many more questions I actually want to ask you about the Taxi Takes, but I do want to move into your more recent work. I also saw that, according to your website, it says your newest film, Women in Islam. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So that actually follows from, you know, the class business that you're talking about, which is, you know, the drivers and passengers will belong to different class backgrounds. The students usually will be more educated. And given the fact that India is this incredibly secular country, you can always count on the fact that there'll be an interesting juxtaposition of just the religious backgrounds in a taxi. So I, being a woman myself, I went to Bombay and I found that there's all these women taxi drivers, and I found that incredibly exciting. It's a very oppressive city. Women independently driving a taxi was even more, juicy, so to speak. And then I just happened to meet one taxi driver who was who represented so many contradictions. She was young, she was a woman, she was a taxi driver, and she was a Muslim. And, you know, one of the things I was focusing on in this project was this notion of Islamophobia, since there has been a lot of talk of it in various forms. And India has the third largest Muslim population in the world. So these women taxi drivers became an interesting character or a way of looking at all these different notions of identity and faith.
What I found really interesting on that clip that you have is what, you know, as a feminist, I perk up when I hear about women's issues, and there's the clip and you immediately go into the discussion of burqas, right? And so all the media, we hear about burqas and this feminist issue, but for me personally, what I hear reeks of ethnocentrism, like the conversation we hear in the mainstream media here about what we think women should be doing with their bodies and how to clothe themselves really irks me. And can you talk a little bit about that? You address it in the video.
Right, so I was trying not to bring that up because I was hoping people would watch it.
Okay, but so I'll just give a teaser.
Right, but of course, the Muslim taxi driver, she essentially, in her real life, does wear a burqa, and hence, you've got this garment which is loaded with so many issues worldwide, from how it's been banned in France. There's a lot of controversy taking place within Europe. And then to have this woman who, you know, effortlessly manages to, you know, straddle both worlds, one of being an independent woman driving a taxi, very male-dominated profession, of course, and then also, you know, very comfortably wear a burqa and be able to voice her, you know, perspectives about everything from terrorism to women's rights, was just phenomenal.
That's great. I think that'll definitely get our listeners wanting to watch that piece. Okay, as we conclude, is there anything you'd like to talk about? What are your plans now that you've graduated? What, anything else you want to add?
Well, I'm just planning on trying to do good outreach and promotion for my work, look for a job, travel America, hopefully go back to India with, you know, a lot of good stories and make my family proud.
Well, you made your IMA family proud.
Thank you.
We think your work's great. Thank you so much for being with us today. Again, that's Vandana Sood, www.thetaxitakes.com. And now we're going into another song. honored to have the director of IMA as our second featured interview today. Marty Lucas is an artist and media activist. His work explores the links of technological with the language of control and forms of resistance, both in the relation to the city, to the machinery of industrial war, and in the technology of communication. We asked Marty here today to talk with us about his current project, Hiroshima Bound, Growing Up in the Atomic Age. Welcome, Marty.
Hi, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's great. We're so glad to have you. Just to start us off, can you summarize for our viewers what this project is about, for our listeners, rather?
Well, this is a new film project for me that picks up with a variety of issues that have been important for me for a long time. I guess I grew up during the Cold War period, and a lot of people in my family were involved, actually, with atomic weapons or atomic energy research of various sorts. And I was always very aware of a legacy that somehow still seems to be part of American society that's, for me, really a traumatic one. So that's a legacy of Hiroshima, of Nagasaki, of atomic power used as a weapon. And so that's really what I'm trying to dig at here. And, you know, I'm a documentary filmmaker, so for me, I was also really interested in how people talk about Hiroshima and how they don't talk about Hiroshima, and even more importantly, in a certain way, what the images are, what the images that people see are, and what are the ones that they don't see. So that's really what I'm trying to look at, is this kind of systems of representation and how they sort of get in our way when we try to understand these kind of momentous events that have this kind of traumatic aspect to them.
So yeah, definitely. I can definitely relate to that interest in what they don't see. I think that's really something we all are really invested in trying to figure out. Okay, we have a short clip that we're going to play. In this clip, it's a voiceover of you, and it's extremely poetic, serving as a tour guide to the accompanying images. Can you briefly paint a picture for listeners of what the video looks like that will be accompanying this voiceover?
Well, what you're going to see is a combination of still images, American landscape, the West, family photos, archival material, really drawn from a broad variety of sources. Just to say it was particularly important for me to have this kind of, the poetry of still landscape photography, which relates to a painterly tradition, up against these other kinds of images, because photography in particular has been divided, I guess, or at least it operates in different spheres. For instance, people use photography for family purposes, for news purposes, for documentation, and so forth. So those you have to imagine this kind of mix of these different discourses of image making.
Thank you. The landscape images are beautiful, I have to say. Okay, we are going to go. Okay, the landscape image, sorry about that. They're really beautiful. Did you do all the shooting?
Yes, that was part of a residency that I did actually out in the desert for the Center for Land Use Interpretation.
Great. Okay, we are going to go into the clip now.
This is a story about a journey from one empty place to another. To make a joke, a story of a void and avoidance. In 1909, Louis Blériot, the French aviator, on his way to becoming the first man to fly the English Channel, crashed his monoplane on a northern French farm. Blériot set up shop in the farmer's prefabricated cattle shed. When he returned home, he ordered three of these recently invented structures, called hangars locally, from the manufacturer. The architect, Robert Venturi, says there are two kinds of buildings, sheds and ducts. This building on the Nevada-Utah border is a shed, and an empty one at that. This empty hangar in the desert in a landscape made, as Rebecca Solnit puts it, out of light, became for a short while my obsession. The love affair between aviation and photography was an instant hit with the public, As an aviator, Blériot was an early 20th century superstar, his every movement followed by journalists and cameramen. Even today, it's easy to find images of Blériot's flight over the English Channel, the first in a heavier-than-air craft. One French documentary quotes him as he launches himself on his dangerous journey. "My mind is calm, without any emotion, without any impression of reality." Looking at the choices made by cameraman and editor, it is clear that even at this early moment in film history, the image of the hero demands another image, the reaction shot. In Gunsmoke, the viewer is supposed to identify with the hero, Marshall Dillon. But here as well, we learn, the reaction shot is essential. In fact, I identify with the onlooker, the observer of violence.
Here I am, right here. It's not dark. Not dark.
That was a clip from Marty Lucas's current project, Hiroshima Bound, Growing Up in the Atomic Age. Can you talk about a little bit about what led to this film? When did you begin the project, and what were the origins of it?
Well, those are kind of complicated questions, but I guess the origins of it really go way back for me. So I actually went to Hiroshima for the first time in 1973 when I was in college. I took an opportunity to travel and went to Japan. I studied the language and wound up in Hiroshima. But I didn't go back to Japan and didn't pursue that particular area of interest for a long time. I worked, in fact, in news and documentary, but I did work all through the 80s in zones, war zones, basically, of what I would have called low-intensity conflict at the time. So I worked in Lebanon and Syria, the Philippines, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and so forth. So I had a chance to really kind of explore modern warfare from a certain kind of a vantage point. But I also had the opportunity to see how it was represented in the news, for instance. And so that was one origin for me. Then in the 90s, I started to do a series of art projects about war. So I did a piece about the First World War and the battlefields of Flanders. I did another piece about the Cold War. And then I did a third piece, actually, looking at a future war, the idea of laser weapons, which were then being promulgated as a possibility. So those projects kind of pushed me in this direction. And then I had a chance to do this residency that I mentioned before, which was actually on the site of an old air base, and it happened to be the air base where the bomber, the B-29 bomber, the Enola Gay, left on its journey to Hiroshima. So that really inspired me in a certain kind of a way, and I took a lot of pictures, and that really was the most recent germ of this project.
Right. So it's clear that we're seeing a 37-year theme going on at a minimum. So this work is very personal, very autobiographical. And you've addressed this a little bit, what your personal journey is, but I'm curious of what do you foresee, or if maybe you don't, or up to this point, of what is the personal journey you are taking with this project?
Well, I think it's a personal journey that is also a public journey, and I think that's kind of the key. You know, we're coming up at a certain point, there was a feminist movement in the United States that started to promote the notion of the personal being political. And I think that notion is a very, very important one for any artist to consider and understand what their role is, not just in making work, but in making yourself. And so I think for me, this piece is a chance to try to really see, to take all the lessons I've learned over the years and to take all the different ways of talking about life and reality and feelings and put them together in a way that I think we need to do right now. I think that we're in a situation of a lot of different kind of crises that in a way we can't be easily put it together to figure out how to deal with the reality that we've created. And I think that's a problem.
Yeah, I think we all definitely agree with that. I happened to come in last night onto your editing lecture, which I told you afterwards that I wish I could have stayed. Obviously, you're quite the skilled editor. I noticed in this clip, much of it is framed with editing technique, right? So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. There's this one clip where you say, "I realize now the whole of the editorial process is designed to draw attention away from one thing in the shot, the empty frame at its end. The image of the hero demands another image, the reaction shot." Can you explain why you chose these particular concepts, why you chose to use editing as a metaphor to frame this project?
Yeah, because I don't think it's really a metaphor. I mean, I think that if you understand the way that film works and the way that editing works, it's kind of, it's chunks of movement, it's chunks of reality, of time, and of life. And so for me, those cowboy movies that I watched on TV when I was a kid really were offering me a certain way to construct a masculine identity, for starters, but a way of acting in the world. And it's a little bit of a cheat, in a sense. And so what I'm trying to suggest is I learned how to create, through editing, a kind of a way of identifying with an actor where you're not actually an actor yourself. And I think that's really at the core of that type of editing. And it's not the only kind that you see, but it's a really common sort of set of tropes. And so those codes or tropes, whatever you want to call them, really were something that I needed to unpack in this film in order to offer up the idea that we're not bystanders in our own lives, that the drama of our own lives is central to us. And that unless we act like that, we'll very much be swept under by the tides of history.
Were you unpacking that for yourself, for the viewer? Can you even separate the two?
It's very much for me, I think, initially, because what I realized is, you know, when you go to a job of work, which, you know, as a freelancer, for most of my life I would do, you go and work at a news station or work on a PBS project, basically they all have their own way of talking about things. And so for me, it was really, I think we're at a time where all those different discourses, to use the term, those different ways of talking about the world, kind of, they need to be unpacked and relinked. Because I don't think that they're really producing, no longer, if they ever did, knowledge. They're producing a kind of a fake understanding of the world, a sense that allows us to be complacent about things we shouldn't be complacent about. And so for me personally, it's the immanent critique. It's the way to get me off of my own tail, so to speak, and reinvigorate my own activism, and kind of, I don't know, you know, hopefully give myself the freedom to say more things in better ways.
Right. I think that'll be very inspiring to current IMA students and future. Let's switch hats real quick. Unfortunately, I would love to talk to you more about this project, but if you could briefly switch hat to director of IMA and tell us really quick about the program for prospective students.
Wow.
Okay. In 1 minute or less.
Yeah, 1 minute or less. You know, that's kind of barely going to do any kind of a justice to the program, but the Integrated Media Arts Program is exactly the right place to do the kind of things that I was just talking about doing. In other words, these are discourses, these are ways of making a work, of working. It's, we've got one foot in journalism, another foot in the art world, another foot very much in the city. So I think this is really at the heart of what modern media making needs to be. It demands a kind of a flexibility and a kind of an ability to move across systems and be able to see them for what they are and tweak them a little bit and have fun doing it. You know, so that's really what the program is for me. It's this mix.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's great to have you with us. And we are now going to move into a musical break.
Thank you. This is Sasha Wurzel, one of your IMA hosts. And now we have a piece from Kate Kuneth. Kate came to the IMA program as a photographer. Her work in previous years has been driven by surreal portraiture. In the IMA program, she is exploring ways to reveal character through new media. Here's her piece.
Takes two brains. when she gets old.
But I'm almost there.
She's pretty old already.
66? They've got a lot of history. Is that right?
Yeah.
They have history. You have to admit it's right. Sounds so old.
Over here.
This is Sister Kate. Oh, that's awesome.
She had a wonderful life, and she was a good friend to a lot of people, and very, very helpful. I remember when my husband died, she just came into the house and took over for me. She was always there when you needed her.
She needs a little help now. Help remembering.
Okay, we're going to get going in a few minutes. And yeah, I would think we'll talk more tomorrow. Are you recording this?
Are you recording?
I'm writing it down.
She's writing it down.
Okay.
Recording.
And that was an experimental audio piece by Kate Kuneth. This has been Cassie Wagler, Sam Fader, and Sasha Wurzel for IMA Radio. You can find a podcast of the show on the Hunter Film and Media website. Thanks for listening to our first show. And now, here's a song by the Brazilian Girls.